Welcome to Ideas, I'm Paul Kennedy. Tonight, part two of While You Were Out, Jeff Warren's Adventures in Sleep and Dreaming. In part one, Jeff followed the first half of a night's sleep, when most of our really deep sleep happens. He discovered that despite all of its chemical functions, sleep has been shaped by culture as well. For example, if we turn out our artificial lights and sleep from dusk to dawn, we'll all get up naturally for a spell in the middle of most nights, as our ancestors seem to have done, and then we'll settle in for a second sleep. Today, in part two, Jeff turns his attention to the last half of a night's sleep, when most of our dreaming occurs. Jeff Warren's adventure to the frontier of dreaming starts in the sleep lab of Montreal's Sacré-Cœur Hospital, where Phil Stenstrom has 30 electrodes hooked up to Jeff's head and face as he sleeps.
It's 3:50 at night. We're in the third sleep cycle.
In our culture, a good night's sleep has about 5 or 6 sleep cycles, with a brief wake-up between each one. Phil Stenstrom is tracking my night's sleep on electroencephalogram monitor, or EEG, and typing observations into his computer.
He's been asleep now for about a good four and a half hours.
Each cycle begins with short stages of light sleep. In the first half of the night, that's followed by 30 to 40 minutes of deep, slow-wave sleep, and then a brief shot of REM, or rapid eye movement sleep. That's when our most vivid dreaming occurs. Tonight, like always, everything is right on schedule.
Not too long ago, came out of deep sleep. REM sleep should be on its way.
About this time of night, REM starts to dominate the sleep cycles, and the slow-wave sleep drops off. As McGill University's Barbara Jones explains, these are two very different experiences for the body.
Slow-wave sleep is a restful state. It's a restful state for both the body and for the brain. It is characterized by inactivity and therefore lower metabolism. The other state of sleep, however, is its other name, paradoxical. In that, during that state, rapid eye movements occur, and there is a tremendous amount of activity going on in the brain. Despite that, the body is the least active, and in fact, the muscle tone is suppressed.
It's slowly transforming itself into a REM stage. We can see that the muscle tone is slowly, progressively going down, and the brain waves are starting to look more and more like brain waves we have when we're awake.
You can't miss the REM patterns when they come up on the EEG. The little lines that represent brain waves start to scribble furiously.
It's got that nice little REM style to it. Very distinct type of brainwave activity. We're starting to see that happening right now.
The EEG activity that Phil sees may look like waking, but there's one very big difference. All sensory input from the outside world is cut off. Consciousness is directed inwards, enmeshed in a fantastically elaborate and vivid internal model of the world. We call this dreaming.
Oh yeah, here it goes there. The muscle tone just shot dramatically down. Right now he is absolutely, well, hardly any muscle tone at all, which means that if he wasn't sleeping and tried to move, well, he probably couldn't move.
My muscles are paralyzed, so I don't act out my dreams.
Now all we're missing is those rapid eye movements, and oh yeah, here they are. We got the first one right here. See how sharp that was? His eyes just darting all over the place.
My jerking eyes are driven by little electrical eruptions from the brainstem, but also by the dream images themselves, which I'm scanning in my sleep.
Yeah, here we go. So now he's officially in REM sleep. Now we'll be waiting to wake him up. We'll be sending off a little beep in the other room, and hopefully he'll be able to share what adventures he was going through while sleeping.
Those adventures will be difficult for me to recall, though, because the short-term memory centers of our brains are basically disconnected when we sleep. But this doesn't mean our dreams aren't being encoded somewhere in the brain. research shows that long-term memory is, if anything, even more active in REM. This may have to do with REM's original evolutionary purpose, and the belief among some researchers that REM's real value is for infants more than for adults.
REM sleep is most intense and it occupies the greatest amount of time early in life, during a period when the brain is developing most rapidly. So it makes a lot of sense that REM sleep has something to do with brain development.
Jerry Siegel is director of UCLA's Center for Sleep Research. He and other researchers have found that as fetuses, we spend almost all our time in REM. Newborns sleep about 16 hours a day, half of which is spent in REM sleep. By the time we're grown up, it's down to an average of about 1.5 hours of REM a day. This is also true of other mammals and many birds. Siegel thinks REM dreaming might be when the brain lays down its long-term neural networks and continues to maintain them throughout life.
We know the use-it-or-lose-it phenomenon certainly applies to brain development and even maintenance of connections in adulthood. That is, if certain synapses are not used, they will be occupied by other neural connections. There's a competition going on in the brain, and this is particularly intense in development. So REM sleep may be a kind of movie that's played, dictated by our genetics, that stimulates systems that are not otherwise being stimulated.
REM is when the basic genetic instructions for life get laid down. How to walk, how to see, how to endear yourself to mom. An increasingly popular theory is that REM is when we rehearse genetically encoded survival skills. This is why, even when we grow up, we spend a disproportionate amount of dream time running from monsters and big animals. Dreams are like virtual reality simulators, test-driving old fight-or-flight programs. And it works because to the brain, dreamed action is the same as real action. This theory is supported by experiments done in the 60s. French researchers took a group of cats and disabled the part of their brain that normally prevents them from acting out their dreams. Barbara Jones describes how the cats, completely asleep, sit up in their cages and leap into survival action.
The most common behavior in cats was what we call a defensive or rage behavior. So the animal would bat out in the air with its paws, defending itself, flattening of the ears, and so on. So this was then a visualization of acting out of dreams, which then emerged in cats, as we know in, they are in humans, as very complex stories, if you like, accompanied with full behavioral repertoire. It was only, I think, 20 years later when this syndrome was discovered in humans and the name assigned REM behavior disorder. And interestingly, it also emerged. There seemed to be more male patients, and oftentimes the dreams can indeed be violent and are reported first by the wife who is being assaulted in the bed.
When we act in our dreams, when we wind up for that karate kick or run from that stranger, two copies of the dream action are created in the brain. One copy is sent out to the body, but it's blocked at the spinal cord, which is what prevents us from acting out our dreams, that is, unless you're one of Gervais' cats. But the second copy is not blocked. It makes it through to the sensory cortex and becomes a full-blown sensation of a karate kick. And your brain remembers it that way, even though you might not. That dream experience joins all the other memories queued up in our brains, the ones that come from our real lives. After all, it's not all primitive survival skill rehearsal in there. We also dream of birthday parties and our aunt's special cookies and that kid who works at the corner store.
What happens when you're dreaming? Dreams are clearly constructed from our memories, and it clearly puts them together in wacky and bizarre ways.
Robert Stickold, a Harvard researcher, has been very successful in showing that as we dream, we're really watching memories being stored and organized.
Our theory is that what the brain is doing is looking at memories that have very tenuous and weak connections at the moment and asking, are these important connections? Are these connections that we should put together more strongly? And so you see in your dreams these things put together that they make a certain kind of sense, but you never would have thought in waking to put them together that way.
Different kinds of memory are processed at different times of the night. During the 5 to 6 episodes of REM sleep, when we have our most vivid dreams, Tickle believes we're seeing our procedural memory being activated, how we do something, like how we ride a bike or how we play music.
If you talk to a pianist or to a gymnast, they'll often talk about working on a passage or working on a move and spending hours working on it and just not be able to master it. And they'll tell you that they then go away from it and they come back the next day and they sit down and first time they've got it. And it's like magic. And if you ask them about it, they say, well, I was probably just tired when I was done practicing and I just needed to rest a while. But if I push them and I say, so if you had practiced in the morning, you could come back after lunch and you'd be fine. And then they get this funny smile and they say, well, better to wait to the next day. Overnight, the brain is doing something to take what it learned during the day and lock it in and even strengthen it.
In a now famous experiment, sleep researchers tracked the neural firing patterns in the brains of mice as they navigated a maze. At night, as the mice slept, the exact pattern of activation repeated itself over and over again in REM sleep. If mice could talk, it's a good bet they would say they were dreaming of long, twisty corridors.
This concept of sleeping on a problem, which I have found in many different languages, they have it in Japanese, they have it in German. You sleep on a problem when you have a lot of information in your head already, and you don't know how to fit it together. And it's almost a magical process. But the brain seems to have a function in sleep where it takes memories that it has and it puts them together and it finds out what fits together and what doesn't. The example I always give is a film editor. If you sat behind a film editor while they were putting together a news show and just watched their screen, what would you see? You'd see a little patch of some news event. Then it would fast forward, then it would cut to a completely different news story, then it might go back to the first one, then it might rewind action, you'd see everything going backwards. You would look and you'd say, this is really bizarre. And there'd be no way looking at that to even guess what story the producer was putting together, because you don't get to see the final form.
Though we may not get to see the final form, other researchers, like Harvard's Deirdre Barrett, think we can get quite a lot out of following the process.
My basic belief about what dreams are is that they're just thinking and cognition in a different biochemical mode, and that we work on the same kinds of problems and reflect on the same kinds of concerns, probably during all of sleep, but it's certainly more obvious during dreaming when the brain is more active. The same issues that we do during our waking state.
Barrett's book, The Committee of Sleep, is full of examples of people who've used dreams for problem solving, including Elias Howe, who was stumped as to how to get the needle to work on the first sewing machine.
Back then, there were only handheld needles with the hole at the opposite end from the tip. And so he was trying to figure out how to take one of those needles and hold it in some way where it could go through the fabric. And of course, this just didn't work, and that's where he was stuck. And so he had a dream where he was in a jungle, and he was suddenly surrounded by savages who had spears, and they told him that if he didn't finish his sewing machine immediately, they were going to kill him. And it was a nightmare, and he was terrified, but then he saw that their spears all had holes down at the pointed tip. And he woke both in terror, but with this aha, that that's where you need to put the hole in a sewing machine needle.
Barrett found her own students were able to find solutions to various problems using her technique of dream incubation. This starts with learning to remember your dreams.
Keeping a pad and pen by the bed to write them down, telling yourself right as you fall asleep that you want to remember your dreams, and when you first wake up, not leaping out of bed and thinking about something else immediately, but just trying to lie there quietly and see if there's any hint of dream content, because often a dream will come back right then.
The next step is to influence what you dream about.
Once you're recalling dreams well, the specific advice I give people, take a problem that they want to work on a dream and write it down as a brief phrase or sentence and keep that by your bed and review it. Just read through the phrase or sentence just before going to bed and think about it for a moment. And then once you've turned out the lights, visualize the problem as a concrete image if you can possibly make it a concrete image. Visualize yourself dreaming about it. Visualize yourself waking up and writing something that's a dream on that notepad. And just hold that, the topic and the idea that you want to dream about it as you're drifting off.
So why don't more people try to capture their dreams? Dr. Barrett says it's cultural.
When I was doing the more historic research for the Committee of Sleep, a huge proportion of the examples that I found of problem solving were from other cultures where dreams are more emphasized. Many more from India and from certain parts of Africa, where people are rather explicitly taught to listen to their dreams for wisdom. That suggests that although this phenomena will happen to some people spontaneously anyway, that it really can be increased just by knowing about it and, you know, having those beliefs and putting a bit of effort into consciously facilitating it.
So if dreams are so important for learning, why are they so hard to remember? Stephen LaBerge has a good answer for that. He's a psychophysiologist at Stanford University. LaBerge spoke with me in a car on the way to a dream workshop in Hawaii.
Dream remembering must be a very recent addition. It's a cultural artifact of humans telling stories and talking about their experience and saying, this very strange thing just happened to me, and telling the tale. But it's clearly obvious that for non-linguistic mammals, which is the other 25,000 species on Earth that don't talk about their dreams, remembering dreams explicitly would be very maladaptive, because then you wouldn't know whether the experiences you were remembering had actually happened or not, because you haven't got a concept actually happened or not. So the example I like to give is if the cat were to have a dream it remembered, say a wish fulfillment dream, that the dog next door is dead and a family of mice have moved into the doghouse. So that's even better. So wakes up, remembers that that's the way it is, jumps over the fence, gets eaten by the dog, and doesn't pass on genes for remembering dreams.
In humans, dream recall is not maladaptive because we have language to help us distinguish between the things we dream and the things we really experience. LaBerge thinks this creates the possibilities that help give humans our mental edge.
For evolution to work, and now I'm going to be talking about the evolution of ideas, the concept is that we need, first of all, a range of variation, and the wider the range, the better, from which ideas or whatever is to be evolved will be selected. So we need some method of generating diversity in the system in the face of the opposite tendencies emerging from learning, which decreased diversity. If we didn't have a state in which we subjected our associative networks to a readjustment in the levels of associations, what would be happening is the more we learned how the world was, the associations we expected, we would get ourselves into deeper and deeper grooves that we couldn't get out of. We'd lose flexibility as we got older at a much faster rate than we do anyway. So it may be that what's happening in dreaming of the most value to people is enhancing creativity, keeping the system loose enough to allow for innovation.
All right, well, it's 4 o'clock in the morning. I'm going to be waking you up.
Back in the lab now, I've been asleep for about 4 hours, and I've been in REM for the last 40 minutes. Enough time for lots of potential dream activity.
All right, well, it's showtime.
Phil moves his hand over the alarm button.
Hello?
Hello, Jeff.
Hi.
Hi, would you mind sitting down?
I sit up in bed, groggy.
Could you please describe the very last thing that was going through your mind before you were awakened?
The dream was, it's complicated. A family went up to the railway tracks, and as the train was, right before, there had been a sort of film there it was a film starring a woman who would get on the tracks and she would dance, but she would move her body like a star. She would turn into a bright light.
I'll tell Phil more about this dream later. But first, a little clarification of the state of dream research. Phil works for Tori Nielsen, who runs this sleep laboratory. He's a psychiatrist and an expert on dreaming.
Well, it's difficult to talk about the main currents in dream research because so many of the answers in dreaming are still lacking. And so much of what's going on in dream research is theoretical. Everyone has their pet theory of how dreaming works, what the function of dreaming is, how dreaming should be used, where dreaming comes from. This can be frustrating to somebody working in the area, let me tell you, because in most areas of science, I think, there are predominant theories, and most of the research is organized around either proving or disproving those predominant theories. But in dream research, it seems a bit different.
Dream study used to have a predominant theory that everyone tried to prove and disprove. That was Freud's.
Freud was not scientific in the sense that we think of scientific today, but he was scientific in that he explored systematically. He had a theory, and he had subjects. He would take his theory and use that to examine the dreams of his subjects, his patients. And then, based upon what he observed with his patients, he would further elaborate his theory.
Freud, of course, believed that dreams were weird because they were disguised wish fulfillment, camouflage for various, usually sexual, drives. But then REM sleep was discovered, a distinct physiological state in the brain that seemed to correspond to periods of vivid dreams. Suddenly, it seemed like dreams had a physical cause, not a psychological one. Eventually, the neurophysiologists, the hardware guys, pushed out the psychoanalysts, the software guys.
What you see is what you get in a dream. It doesn't need interpretation, at least mine don't. They're embarrassingly obvious.
For the past 20 years or so, the king of the hardware guys has been Harvard psychiatrist Alan Hobson.
What we could do is take a completely new approach to dreaming, look at it in terms of cognitive activity, and come up with new theories about what REM sleep might be doing for us, why we bother to do this. It's certainly not so that we can tell each other stories about dreams during the daytime or go pay outrageous fees to a psychoanalyst to try to figure them out.
Hobson still enjoys baiting Freudians, though it's no longer because he's on the outside looking in. In fact, his has become the dominant paradigm for understanding dreaming.
Another way to go about studying dreams is to not study them, to study REM sleep, and then see what that information tells you about dreaming. And that's what McCarley and I did as young psychiatrists. We were astonished at what we found. We found that certain brain chemicals that are essential to waking experience, the ability to attend, the ability to perceive the outside world instead of one's internal fantasies, the ability to remember, the ability to know where you are. All these chemicals are withdrawn from the brain progressively during the stages of sleep. During non-REM sleep, the output of these chemicals goes down to about half, and in REM sleep it goes to zero.
But other chemicals take their place, most notably acetylcholine. At the brainstem signal, acetylcholine courses out, activating and deactivating different regions, giving the brain its unmistakable REM character. Take, for example, my dream about the weird spinning lady on the railway tracks.
And she would move and undulate in such a way as the train approached, it would pass her, but she would be elevated above the tracks, doing this amazing spinning motion. And this was seen as something that this family watched in a movie and was, or sort of in real life, but also in a film. And it was a beautiful thing. And the children all went to the tracks with the family, and they stood there, and they were wondered how she did it, and they were just full of wonderment. Because it was this beautiful thing, like a fairy. It was like fairy dust.
In Hobson's view, if you want to understand dream content, just look at what part of the brain is being fired up.
In REM, the brain has reactivated, but it's different. The activation pattern is very different from waking. There are certain structures which are more activated than they are in waking, and they include the emotional system. And that makes us very happy.
Yeah, there was a real feeling of ecstasy part. It was really like transfixed. It was beautiful. It was like watching angels.
In certain areas of the cortex, the upper brain, which have to do with the synthesis and organization of visual spatial information, are more highly activated in dreaming.
Anyway, that was also part of a larger dream about where I was looking at this park. It was at Hyde Park in London, and I was listening to these voices, these radio voices, talking about a crime that had happened there. And the camera was panning back and receding. And then it was sort of looking at London as a map, as a whole, and Hyde Park was hit, was head shrunk. camera panned back more. All of a sudden I was looking at all of England. And then it panned back again to the entire planet. It was amazing. And then it panned back a camera again, and it was all of a sudden it was the entire solar system. And there was these voices and news voices talking about issues related to the entire solar system. And finally it panned back to the entire universe.
There are certain structures in the brain which are less activated in REM than in waking, and they include the frontal cortex. And the frontal cortex is the area of the brain which most scientists believe has to do with directed thought, with working memory, and with the whole host of conscious state functions that are available to us in waking. They're not available to us in REM sleep. This explains dream amnesia without looking at repression or some such notion. It explains the crazy quilt aspect of dreams, the bizarreness of dreams.
There's a little dream episode that didn't happen with me jumping on a chin-up bar and swooping my feet and kicking my friend Pat in the chest just as a joke and he falling back into a bathtub. I didn't tell you about that.
You don't have a guidance system to organize the material the way you do in waking.
And also, before that, I was going out to dinner with four friends at a restaurant, and we were trying to find a place to eat, and finally settled in this one Italian restaurant with a zinc countertop, metal, and everyone was sort of, there was nobody left, we weren't going to stay there, but the waitress was charming.
This is basically activation synthesis. Activation synthesis arises from the physiology. It doesn't go from the dream down. It says, hey, look, this is the physiology of the brain during REM sleep. What does this have to do with the conscious experience of dreaming? The answer is a lot, and we think probably all of it.
In Hobson's view, the emotional centers of our brain fire up a bunch of random images, which are themselves a mix and match from memory. And when you think about the sheer richness of 21st century source material, from Hollywood blockbusters to family barbecues to Saturday morning cartoons, it's hardly surprising that our dreams can seem pretty bonkers.
That occurred before the weird fairy dance starlight in front of the train, and before the world, the panning back the world camera, which was totally trippy. Because I kept wondering how far back the camera was going to go. I wondered if it would go back one more notch past the universe, and it was that kind of scared me, that idea, because I knew I would be seeing how the universe fit into an even larger context.
That's the dream Jeff Warren had in the sleep lab of Montreal's Sacré-Cœur Hospital. I'm Paul Kennedy. You're listening to Hour 2 of While You Were Out, Jeff's Adventures in Sleep and Dreaming, on Ideas on CBC Radio 1 and on Sirius Satellite Radio across North America.
So how can you reduce a dream like the one I had to a bunch of chemical imbalances? Are dreams as meaningless as this physiological explanation makes them seem? The mental equivalent of digestion? Not even Hobson goes this far.
Dreams are elaborate psychic products worthy of our study, but we need to break with our ways of thinking about them. You know, it's not, I'm not a nonsense theorist. I think there is some nonsense in there, but I think most of it makes a lot, most of my dreams make a lot of sense. I think what you see is what you get. Why interpret them? I mean, they are emotionally salient on their face.
One of the more popular theories of dreams is that they are emotionally overblown for a reason, to emphasize important memories. That's why our family and friends feature in so many of our dreams. Still, for all their value, in Hobson's theory, we remain passive observers of a bodily function. Nowhere is that more apparent than when one of Hobson's brain modules misfires.
I just had a very clear dream.
Researchers call these parasomnias.
Yeah, it was just a very clear voice speaking to me behind my head, just saying, Harry versus Met Potter.
Something about the self-consciousness of being in the lab triggered one for me in Montreal.
I tried to tell you a couple times, but I couldn't get it out. It was frozen. It has never happened before to me.
Phil reassured me that he hadn't spoken. It was an oral hallucination, a piece of the dream world superimposed over top of the waking one. The fact that it was accompanied by an inability to speak gave us both a pretty good idea of what had happened.
I thought I was telling you, but I realized I wasn't making any noise.
Sleep paralysis is one of the more common parasomnias, thought to be responsible for medieval accounts of creeping succubae and the 20th century craze for alien abductions.
It scared me. It kind of So it was the thing that kind of woke me up a little bit. But then I didn't wake me up entirely because then I tried to speak and I realized I was still dreaming because I couldn't, my mouth, I couldn't, it was frozen. I couldn't talk, I was trying, it came out in this mutter.
This state happens when motor inhibition from the REM state is somehow not turned off and the dreamer wakes in bed, paralyzed. Being awake when your motor output is shut down can be terrifying. But when the reverse happens and you're asleep and your motor output somehow fires up, well, that can be far more dangerous. This, of course, is sleepwalking. And as Hobson explains, it usually happens in slow wave sleep when there's very little activity going on in the brain.
How can you walk in your sleep? I mean, you're supposed to be inert. But in fact, you can get the lower motor centers going. And walking is done, by the way, by the brainstem down. You don't need the cerebral cortex to walk. You need the cerebral cortex to decide to walk or decide to stop walking. But all the walking is like the Yellow Pages, you know, let your fingers do the walking. Mm-hmm. Let your brainstem do the walking. That's what is activated in sleepwalking. And the upper brain is not. It's exactly the opposite of sleep paralysis. It's in sleep paralysis, you wake up unable to move because REM sleep motor inhibition has extended into the subsequent waking state. In sleepwalking, the cerebral cortex is out to lunch. It's in stage four, a big slow wave sweeping across it. And the poor kid is walking around his house, wondering if he wants to go to the bathroom, get out on the roof, you know, go to the garden or whatever. It's a classic example of this dissociation that I'm talking about.
If you can dissociate brain modules like this, if you can introduce sleep functions into waking and wake functions into sleeping, it makes you wonder, what else can be mixed and matched? Suppose you could introduce another waking function to dreaming, say, sustained self-conscious rational thought. What then? Well, it turns out you can. It's called lucid dreaming, and in the past 20 years or so, it's gone from underground New Age practice to full-blown scientific curiosity, one that even Hobson, the sober physiologist, has embraced.
This is fantastic. I mean, you'll be able to notice that you're dreaming when you're dreaming. It's a very fragile state, very, very dynamic, elusive. It's quickly lost. You either wake up or you're pulled back into the dream, but you keep thinking hard about it, and you can actually change the plots. You can do whatever you want. You can fly, which I love to do. Most people like to fly in their dreams. And you can make love to whomever you please. People who are lucid have a lot of fun with their dreams, and I think it's easy to teach, especially young people, to do it. In the technical language of psychology, it's a dissociation. You have components of the wake state entering into the dream state. Lucid dreaming is not REM sleep anymore. It's REM sleep slash waking. You can make these wonderful movies inside your head, but now you've got a director. The dorsolateral prefrontal cortex has waked up and is running the show. It's wonderful.
I was very fortunate to have lucid dreams as a child. They occurred spontaneously, and I think the main turning point for me was the lucid dreams that I had when my father passed away at a very early age. He was 49 and I was 11.
I met Patricia Keelan in Hawaii. She's become a star in the small world of lucid dream research, but only after she discovered it for herself.
But shortly after he died, he appeared in a dream, and what struck me about that was that he had had multiple sclerosis all the time that I knew him, and had been confined to a wheelchair, so I never saw my father walk in waking life. But after he died, I saw him in a dream, and the first thing I said to him was, "Where's your wheelchair?" And he said, "Well, I don't need that anymore, honey." Now, I knew it wasn't the waking world. It was a dream world, but it worked just as well. He felt very vividly real to me. We could still hug. I still felt connected to him. I had several dreams with him, and I would update him, you know, as if these were the visits that we used to have to the hospital. I would update him on the family situation, what was going on, and with full confidence said, "Oh, yes, of course I'll see him again."
Keelan continued to have spontaneous lucid dreams. And then in the 80s, she read Stanford psychophysiologist Stephen LaBerge's popular paperback on the subject.
It wasn't until I read Stephen's first book, Lucid Dreaming, that I realized there was an actual term for dreaming with awareness. And what struck me in reading his book was that he said you could have these dreams at will. And it had never passed through my mind that that was a possibility.
Instead of you, I've seen it happen frequently with people learning, I never notice, you know, that I'm dreaming. It's my dream always fools me.
LaBerge is no New Age prophet, but a solid, reputable sleep scientist. The one who earlier told us dreams may be the brain's way of generating diversity. Here on a rainy afternoon, he's addressing a workshop on Hawaii's Big Island.
That's what I do, right? Well, that's what you did.
LaBerge hosts his workshops through a for-profit company he set up called the Lucidity Institute. Several times a year, at the cost of a couple thousand U.S. dollars, 30 or so curious amateurs meet in this botanical retreat for 10 days of lucid dream instruction. I took part in one of these workshops back in November of 2004.
That means every time you perceive a dream something, that should be part of the thought. Ha, here's a way next time, and I will.
Most of the people at the workshop are middle-aged professionals, architects, writers, doctors, software engineers.
Across my prototypical dream sign, which is filmmaking. I missed it this time, but I'll get it next time.
Many are hoping to experience lucid dreaming for the first time. Others want to get better at it, to refine their skills.
So I saw the door to where the space that I'm sleeping in, and that's in the wrong spot. So I'm definitely dreaming right now. I just want to breathe and relax into it because I've knocked myself out of them by being too excited before.
LaBerge is a lucid dreamer himself.
As Dominic pointed out, we again want to really emphasize that every time one happens, see if you can avoid thinking, oh, how dumb can I be, and instead say, wow, there's a good one, and the next time that happens, I'm going to use it, so that there each one...
As a sleep psychologist, he sees lucid dreaming as a wonderful opportunity to study how the mind builds its model of the world. With lucid dreaming, the cool and collected investigator is in the dream and actively taking notes. Although reports of lucid dreaming date back to Aristotle, until the 70s, the consensus from the scientific community was lucid dreaming is impossible. Lucid dreams were really micro-awakenings, little blips of wakefulness which the sleeper confused with dreaming.
In the 70s, the scientific community was pretty much universally agreed that lucid dreaming was impossible. Why impossible? Because it didn't make any sense to say that while you're asleep and dreaming that you could be conscious. Because after all, doesn't everybody know that being asleep is being unconscious? And so thinking in that kind of loose way about consciousness then confused people into the obviously mistaken idea that we can't be conscious while dreaming of what's going on inside our minds as opposed to the environment we're sleeping in.
In a Stanford laboratory in 1978, LaBerge set out to prove the scientific community wrong.
How could we prove that people could be fully reflective during lucid dreaming to the point of saying, here I am dreaming yet still asleep? That, of course, is an empirical challenge.
LaBerge met that challenge with an idea he got from another sleep researcher. The only part of our bodies not paralyzed in REM is our twitching eyes. Most of this twitchy movement is produced by random electrical discharge. But one night, this researcher noticed in one of his sleeping subjects, during a period of REM, that the eyes were moving back and forth in a very regular left-to-right pattern. He woke the sleeper up and asked him what he was dreaming about. The answer? A ping-pong game. It turns out that there can be a direct correlation between our gaze in the dream and the movement of our real eyes.
So the idea is basically, because I have the usual kind of control over my body and in the lucid dream states I do in the waking state, of course I can look to my left ear, right ear, and back to center when I become lucid. And that would serve as a signal, a pre-agreed upon signal, saying I know I'm dreaming now. And then we could see, when did that eye movement appear? Did it appear during a quasi-waking state experience? Was it in REM sleep? When does it occur physiologically? And so we'd have a physiological objective marker indicating when the report occurred of lucid dreaming. And that would then be a validation, assuming we find any connection. And of course, we did.
LaBerge secured electrodes to his scalp next to his eyes. With co-researcher Lynn Nagel watching over him, he closed his eyes and eventually fell asleep. Several hours later, he woke up, lucid, inside a dream.
I found myself floating in the void, in the darkness, nothing going on. And I realized, I must be asleep because I don't have a body.
Up in the lab, Nagel watched the polygraph. LaBerge had entered REM sleep. His eyes were twitching and his EEG showed distinct REM activity.
And I floated around in the darkness for maybe 30 seconds until I saw bits of imagery floating by, trivial material, like an old phone book or something like that. But gradually the imagery began to increase in scope and vividness until I found myself in a dream world, fully embodied, and then I was capable of making an eye movement signal because I had eyes to move.
It was the signal she'd been waiting for. Two clear, smooth eye movements picked up by the electrodes. LaBerge was communicating to her from down in the dream world.
Later on, the more typical experiences in the laboratory would be in the midst of an intense experience, enough bizarre events occur that I say, this is a dream, and then would remember to signal by looking left, right, and then carry out some particular further tasks.
Along with an elite group of dreamers, LaBerge would drop off to sleep, become lucid, and send back on-the-scene reports from the dream world using agreed-upon patterns of eye signals. They investigated dream time by signaling and counting off in the dream. They held their dream breaths and looked for corresponding changes in nasal air outflow. They alternately counted and sang, watching how activity in the brain shifted from the left hemisphere to the right. In all of these cases, actions carried out in the dream are interpreted by the brain as having really happened. The same neural pathways fire. Everything proceeds exactly as it would in waking, except that motor output is blocked. This gets to why lucid dreaming is so hard to do. Your brain makes no distinction between dreamed action and real action. Somehow, your conscious mind has to figure it all out, and it has to do this on the fly, smack in the middle of a dream that's already fooled all of your senses.
The reason people don't have lucid dreams every night is because they don't sleep with the mental set of doing so. It's long been known, certainly since Freud and far earlier, that we are able to sleep with various mental sets. For example, to wake up when the baby cries, or to wake up just at dawn, or wake up remembering our dreams, and so on. So sleeping with the intention to recognize one is dreaming is a special set. That's the basis of learnable lucid dreaming, is that one can learn simply to sleep with that intention and to recognize the oddities that occur every night in our dreams as a means of telling us we're dreaming.
I fell asleep and realized when I found myself in the backyard of my childhood home that I was dreaming. And I have a fondness for stones in general in waking life. And here was this beautiful stone in the backyard. I picked it up and it was so gorgeous. I thought, wouldn't it be nice if I could bring this back into the waking world with me?
Keelan's dream report served as an inspiration to us at the workshop.
It was a beautiful stone, very vivid, and I thought, if I just hold on to it hard enough and long enough, let's just see what will happen.
To prepare ourselves for lucid dreaming, we sharpened our mental sets by wandering the ground, staring at the weird exotic foliage with eyebrows cocked, asking ourselves, am I dreaming now? In our beds, we repeated our mantra, the next time I'm dreaming, I'll remember I'm dreaming.
So I let my consciousness rise very slowly until I could start to feel the competing mental model of the waking world, starting to feel my physical body on the bed. And as this was happening at the very same time, I could sense that the stone was getting lighter and lighter and dissolving as if it were soap bubbles, disappearing right in front of my dream eyes, which were still functioning, while my physical body was starting to feel the bed, and I thought, oh, no, I'm losing my dream rock. I want to go back and get it.
Keelan and Dr. LaBerge also taught us various tricks to use within the dream itself. We cultivated dream skepticism by practicing what LaBerge called reality checks, inspecting digital watches, reading text, and flipping on and off any available light switches, all of which are notoriously unstable in the dream world. We learned tricks for stabilizing dreams. By spinning our dream bodies or concentrating intently on details, vivid dreams could be re-entered, made concrete.
I slipped back down into the dream, felt the heaviness of the stone increase, felt the weight and the texture. So I came up slowly again, and again, the rock started to dissolve. And I thought, oh no, I'm losing it again. So I went back down.
Sitting in a big circle on the floor of our breezy tropical hut, we shared our dream goals. What we would do once we became lucid. most people wanted to fly and have sex. Others wanted to resolve various personal issues and engage with dream characters. Others, like Keelan, just wanted to experiment.
And I went up and down and up and down, just very gently playing on that edge of dreaming and wakefulness with the illusion growing stronger and then fading. It was just a wonderful experience to see how the dream would fade and then grow stronger, depending on where my focus was and my balance. It was a very good balancing exercise. And when I woke up, of course, I had the dream rock in my mind.
Within a few days, about half the group had experienced a lucid dream. Their reports were ecstatic. Their lucid dreams were more vivid than regular dreams and were often accompanied by delirious emotional highs. The fact that some of the group were having them at all supported LaBerge's big idea. Dreams can be driven by psychology, our motivations and expectations, not only, as Hobson would have it, by changes in physiology and body chemistry. In that way, lucid dreaming itself becomes a way to consciously drive dream narratives and understand something of the motivations and the expectations that create them.
So I think lucid dreaming provides an opportunity to observe how the dream construction process works on the spot. So, for instance, imagine I find myself on a dark road. Now, I can notice this all in a lucid dream. Say, I'm a lucid dream. Hey, interesting. This is a dark road, and I feel a little nervous. Why nervous? And maybe I think there might be some danger. And the moment I think there might be some danger, there appears one on the street, you know, this dangerous character. Now, if I weren't lucid, then I'd probably do something like run away and expect he'd follow me and expect that no matter what I do, he'd catch me, and that's what would happen. In the lucid dream, I can say, all right, let's make a difference. Say, hi there, do I know you? Can I help you? Something like that. Now the dream becomes something else because now it's one of an encounter between two old friends or strangers meeting, but the threatening aspect has changed by my reframing it somehow.
Suddenly, our dreams don't have to be all about automatic behavior, about fighting and flighting. This is the way LaBerge thinks it works. Normally, the way we interact with the world, both dreaming and waking, is driven by our fixed patterns of behavior. They form neural grooves in our brains that we slip into. In this sense, the dream is like a caricature of the self, of our own grotesque anxieties and habits of mind. Lucid dreaming is an opportunity to reroute those neural grooves, to do things a bit differently. And these changes can stick because, again, as we already learned, to the sleeping brain, dreamed action is real action. That's why LaBerge believes that taking control of your dreams can actually change your behavior in waking. We dream who we are, but also who we want to be.
Ever since humans have been humans, this potential has been there, but we haven't really known about it, we haven't made use of it, we haven't developed it, we haven't taught our children how to dream. And so I think the potential for the future of lucid dreaming is something like the Star Trek holodeck, where there's a room you can go into and then have any imaginable experience, anything you can conceive of, so you can use it for education, practice, rehearsal, recreation, and so on, in a way that is safe and simulating a world in the best way your brain can do. So it's a, I think, wonderful potential for human betterment simply there every night we sleep.
It's an inspiring idea, like a scene from The Matrix, except I had yet to have my lucid dream. This is the problem with lucid dreaming. It's really hard to do. There are only a handful of people in the world who can really practice skills in their dreams like Keelan and LaBerge do. Most of us, myself included, just tumble along unheeding. And then, after a week of trying, I finally had a lucid dream.
So I'm standing in some kind of mall, and somehow I know right away I'm dreaming. As soon as this thought pops into my head, everything gets really crisp and clear. Normally my dreams are this sort of washed out, murky quality, but this is razor sharp. It's like no dream I've ever had. It feels exactly like waking. I can even feel the breath in my lungs. So I start to run as fast as I can down a corridor, a bit kind of uncoordinated, like crashing into shoppers.
Hey, watch it, man.
I finally burst through these glass doors, out into the street. I remember my first goal, examine texture. So I reach down and kind of give the pavement a rub, feeling how rough it is on my fingertips. Then I run over to this big oak tree and wrap my arms around it, you know, kind of press my cheek into the bark. I look at my hands and they seem all raw and swollen like these big oven mitts. Goal two is to have a dream conversation. So I try to talk to the security guard that I see.
Go ahead, get out of here.
But he completely ignores me. So I move on to goal three, which is to have dream sex. This turns out to be even harder than having a conversation. Every woman I try to talk to sort of slips away and...
Do you mind leaving me alone?
Yeah, no problem. Eventually, I just give up the whole idea. I mean, clearly I'm having some interpersonal issues in this dream. So I decide to go straight for flying. This at least should be something I can manage. So I take off running, sort of picking up speed until I get to this park. And I kind of windmill my hands, which is when I launch into the air. But I must have jumped too hard because my feet kind of overtake my head and I end up kind of flipped upside down. And eventually I float into the side of this old building and flop back onto the ground. So then I see this big theater marquee above me. I figure I need to get to a higher launch point. So I climb it. I get to the top. I can see this Gotham-style cityscape rolling out in front of me. So I step back and take this huge running jump off the edge of the building. I take off, except I land on another building, about a foot below the one I just jumped off. So I jump again and land on another building. And this keeps up all the way down to the last building, which is about the size of a doghouse. At this point, I'm kind of disappointed, and pretty much the moment my foot touches the ground, I wake up. And that's it. That's my lucid dream.
It may be hard to see how a silly dream like mine is somehow a dispatch from the frontier of consciousness research, but I believe it is. Lucid dreaming is like being beamed down onto the factory floor of your mind. All of these big mechanical processes are at work, the sorting and filtering of memory, the processing of emotion, the updating of neural networks. You get to wander through all of this, clear-eyed and rational, inspecting the walls, rattling the foundations, conducting your own experiments. My brief fling down there drove home the single biggest insight I gained from my research. Though the sleep theorists I met, to be sure, have great disagreements, it hit me that all of their dream theories have one thing in common. Whether it's Siegel's infant development, or Stickold's reshuffling the experiences of the day, or Barrett's inventors solving real problems, or even LaBerge's lucid dreamers practicing behavioral alternatives, all of these scenarios assume that the sleeping brain interprets dream action as real action, and it learns from it. Waking and dreaming consciousness, it turns out, might not be so very different after all. Across the 24-hour spectrum, we think, we act, and we learn. No matter what state we're in, our brain is constantly updating our working model of the world. That's why scientists like Alan Hobson are so excited about the future of dream study.
We are in the brain. We know what's going on. We can study the human brain in action. We can get reports from people. This is the dawn of consciousness research, as much as Galileo's discovery of the telescope is the dawn of astronomy.
In the first hour of this series, we turned that telescope outward and saw how sleep is shaped by history and by culture. In this past hour, we've turned the telescope inward, and we've seen that dreaming too can be shaped by our own experiences, our desires, and our expectations. Now it's your turn. Tonight, as the sleep chemicals stir in your brain, lie down, close your eyes, and see what happens.
And that concludes the final part of While You Were Out, Jeff Warren's Adventures in Sleep and Dreaming. Jeff's book, The Head Trip, Adventures on the Wheel of Consciousness, will be published by Random House in the fall of 2006. While You Were Out was produced for Ideas by Alan Gattell. Technical producer, Dave Field. If you'd like an audio copy of this two-part series, the cost is $26, taxes and shipping included. To order using a credit card, call area code 416-205-7367. Or send a check or credit card information for $26 to Ideas Transcripts, Box 500, Station A, Toronto, M5W1E6. If you'd like to find out what's coming up on Ideas, you can sign up for our weekly online newsletter. Just go to our website at cbc.ca/ideas and follow the links to weekly newsletter. The executive producer of Ideas is Bernie Lucht. I'm Paul Kennedy. Please stay tuned now to CBC Radio 1 and to Sirius Satellite Radio for the hourly news.